On this episode of Teched Out by Full Stack Academy, Jeff and I explain the evolution of programming languages. Why use Python over a more performant language like Fortran? And how do modern languages like JavaScript read so much like English and yet are still understood by our machines? Last time we talked about how computers evolved from their mechanical predecessors from the late 1800s, and these mechanical machines required you to put computations together by physically changing switches, right? You would lift one up and put one down, and these would reflect the tasks that you would ask it, the operations, the adds, the subtracts, whatever it may be. We talked about with enough of these combinations of ons and off, with enough of these combinations of ones and zeros, we can start representing all of the major logical operations of the switch, and with enough of these logical operations, we can start to put together complex tasks. Now, we reflect this with modern-day computing by doing the exact same switches, except without physical things that we're lifting up and down. We're using electrical circuitry, electronic switches. So we have the same capabilities just with ones and zeros, and that's how we tell the machine what sort of electronic circuit to put together, what kind of operation to actually run by feeding it this ones and zeros, these binary instructions.
So I'm wondering at this point, we've got assembly and we've got machine code. We've got this more sort of human readable format, and we've got these ones and zeros. If somebody writes a program in assembly, do they have to kind of hand it off to a translator and they go and say, okay, well, I see the program that you wrote, and I'm going to just translate all of these words that you wrote in assembly into machine code and then actually write the program?
Right.
Is that how it works?
Right. So of course this wouldn't be very effective if we needed like a human translator in the middle, right? But we can go through what's known as a process known as assembling, right? And so when we go through this assembling process, we can actually take our code and essentially convert it. Like imagine like a lookup table, right? Like if I wrote some other language, but I left you like, a bunch of cards of how to convert from like my new made up language to English, you would essentially be able to sit there and convert the two together, right? And that's what this process of assembling was, right? Is taking our information and making it exactly machine code. And at the end of the day, everything has to be machine code.
Right. All ones and zeros when it comes down to it.
Right.
So this is an automatic process, assembling, right? Going from assembly to machine code, the computer could actually just take care of that. So we could literally just write programs in assembly and they would work as long as we put it through some sort of assembler process, right? Well, at this point, I mean, why are we satisfied with assembly, right?
Oh, we're not, Jeff.
We're not.
Like, right. let's not.
We're not coding.
Oh, we don't stop
anymore,
there.
Right.
Let me tell you what we have next. I feel like an infomercial. You know what I mean? It's like
call in the next 5 minutes, and you'll get two assemblers. You'll have more machine codes than you'll know what to do with.
Yeah. Exactly. So. So we're not satisfied. Is the answer
right?
Right. Except. Okay, we'll get to it, but it's pretty insane. You know, do you know someone wrote a game in assembly? Like this low level that's like almost at the level of like machine code. We just talked about how non-abstract. It's like not even like we're talking about like this is no way that people stick with this. Well, Chris Sawyer.
This guy must have been writing in like the 50s, and it must have been like a text-based game, like a choose your own adventure kind of thing, right?
Nope.
Is that what you're talking about?
Nope. I wish I was, Jeff.
What game was
this? Roller Coaster Tycoon.
What?
Yeah. 99%.
I played that game so much when I was growing up.
Pretty much that's, all assembly.
It's a great game. All assembly?
Yeah. So like this, take information from input one and input two and put it into input three. That's how Roller Coaster Tycoon was written.
And that turns into like build a loop-de-loop here in the middle of my coaster and jack up the prices so that...
Pretty insane. So the ticket prices
squeeze
are...
profits out of people.
Yeah,
that's
you're
assembly.
Pretty sick. You're a sick person.
Yeah, well,
you're doing that's not nice. That's not nice. Just squeezing profits out of your virtual people.
Hey, don't hate the player, hate the game. You know.
But it's insane that it was written in this assembly. Like you know,
that is insane.
Yeah. So whatever. I figured I'd point that out. But okay, so we're not satisfied with assembly, right?
Right.
And
he was, but we are not.
Most. I don't know. You have to be off a little, right? Like, yeah, to be satisfied, like, to, like, want to, like, I don't know. Especially because, like, it was a modern game. So, like, there were other options,
right?
Yeah. Okay, so what happened after this? So we didn't want assembly. Who are like some of the big players around now? What changed the field? Why? How did we move away from assembly, and what did it take?
Yeah, so after kind of seeing what we could do with assembly for a little bit, I know that one person who was really adamant that this wasn't good enough was Grace Hopper, the namesake for our school here at Full Stack, our women's coding boot camp, Grace Hopper. So during the 1940s, she was doing research in a couple of different places. She worked at Vassar, she worked at Harvard for a while, and her big thing became, we should be able to write programs as if we're describing things in almost plain English, right? If we can write this layer of abstraction called assembly over machine code, why not take it further? Why not push the boundaries a little bit? Why not come up with other languages that are easier for us to understand so that we can be more productive, so that we can think a lot less, spend a lot less brain power worrying about the specifics of exactly how the computer is going to take care of things, right? We just need to think about the logic. Add these numbers together, put them all on a list over here, divide them later on, right? So we can think in these high level ways, right? It kind of reminds me actually a little bit of math in that I love math, just got to go on a little math
brings
tangent
me back
here,
to
right?
my math days.
But you think about the ancient people performing calculations, and people used things like the abacus, right? And you would perform these arithmetic operations like adding numbers together by kind of sliding beads back and forth on these rods, right? The abacus. And then on top of that, people layered abstractions like mathematical notation, like the Arabic numeral system, right? Where we could write things down and kind of manipulate symbols around and describe stuff that way.
Yeah.
And until then, if you wanted to show somebody some math, you had to like break out your abacus and be like, here, watch, I slide this bead, this bead, and then others, the other beads on this row go in the other direction, right?
You should on your next lecture just bring one with you.
Yeah.
And, like, start off the whole lecture by just being like...
Like I don't.
Yeah, right. First day of class, like...
I gotta get a new abacus. My abacus gets so much work through the course of a cohort.
That's what we
here.
Teach here at Full Stack. We teach the abacus.
Abacus programming.
Abacus programming.
Yeah. But anyway, so Grace Hopper thought, okay, well, we should be able to write something close to English, right? And then the computer can take care of translating that language down into something like assembly or straight into machine code.
Right. I see. So let's continue this abstraction process. Let's put it through what's known as a compiler, right? And like essentially go through this process of compiling, taking it from one state and just turning it into something the machine can understand. Now, of course, this takes time and is a process, right? And there was a lot of debate early on about this, right? There was like, when this idea was proposed, people thought this was crazy. We were going to sacrifice performance, right?
Right.
Like, we're abstracting, and abstracting provides us the ability to be more readable, more tangible, more usable. But because we then have to like assume that our more abstracted version is going to convert into something the machine certainly will understand, there's going to be a losslessness of capability. You're
right.
Not going to be able to do everything that you would be able to do at that bottom level. It wouldn't be as fast.
Right. And that's probably true, I guess, right? If you have to go through this process of compiling, you called it, right? Mm-hmm. Which is sort of just translating from one language into another language, usually a lower level language, right? We take something that looks understandable to us, something that looks like English, and translate it down into binary, say. Right. So that process takes some time, at least. Right. But we also have this idea here where was I going with this? I lost my train of thought.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe you were going to talk about. Yeah. Maybe I'll help you out there. So we talked about abstraction. We talked about compiling. Right. And maybe what you were getting at is like, how did we continue this process? Right. Right. Like, you know, there was a lot of debate around this. And as years went on, people started to realize that to get more people involved in this, to get more people to understand it, to build things faster, it turned out to be more worth it to go through this process of compiling.
Right.
And this is where we started to see the early programming languages like COBOL and Fortran, right?
Yeah. And thank you, by the way. You totally reminded me exactly what I was going to talk about.
Thank you, Jeff. You're welcome.
I have complete faith in you, Corey. Appreciate it. always there for me. You talked about getting more people involved here, right? And that was also, I think, initially a source of some resistance to some people who had been programming in things like machine code and assembly. That was programming to these people. And when we started talking about higher level languages, things that were easier for humans to understand, some people kind of balked at that a little bit and said, well, if we just open it up to everybody, then people are going to be able to build computer programs without putting in the real work. And, you know, it's going to be too easy. We're going to lower the bar and stuff. Like, that was a real concern at the time because people, these purists, thought that programming was done in these, like, very manual, tedious ways.
Right. You know, this still happens to this day, right? Like, this is like, even as we've moved, I'm sure the COBOL engineers look down upon the C++ engineers, and the C++ engineers still look down upon, you know, the Java engineers, and the Java, you know, upon the JavaScript engineers.
Yeah, and JavaScript gets so much crap from people still, right? Oh, that's not a real programming language. Real programmers code in C, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's...
You have to hate your life while you code. That's the rule.
Exactly, right. So, programming should not be fun. Programming should be hard work.
So let's keep going on this path of abstract. Like, why did we continue to abstract? Why did we continue to see languages change throughout the years?
Yeah. So at this point, we've got languages which are a little bit more abstract, a little bit more human readable, things like COBOL and Fortran, as you mentioned, right? And at the same time, hardware isn't just standing still. It's not like we got to the transistor and that was it. Like, computers aren't the same today as they were in the 1940s, 1950s, right? So as computers are evolving, people start to realize that there's this trend emerging, something that you might have heard of as Moore's Law. And the idea here is essentially that hardware was evolving so quickly that computers' processing power was doing something close to doubling about every 2 years. And the amount of memory that we could store in a certain unit of space was also roughly doubling every 2 years. So we've got this exponential effect where after just, you know, a decade of advancements in computer hardware, you've got a computer that's way more powerful, like orders of magnitude more powerful than the one that we had just
like
10 years ago.
32 times, if that trend is true, right?
Yeah.
Or more, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear people say all the time that the computers that we used to send people to the moon in 1969, like, they were less powerful, I think, in many cases, than the calculators that students were using in math class, like, 10 years ago or something.
Right,
which is
definitely
absurd.
Yeah. I think there's no way they're using those calculators anymore, right? Like, because there's
no,
because those are way less powerful than, you know, even close to what our phones can do.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
so,
sure.
I'd imagine, you know,
maybe students are just using their phones in class now.
I guess
I
so. I feel out of touch.
I think my math teachers would have been very upset if we had just taken cell phones out and started doing. How do you know that?
Or
people
an iPad
are,
at least. I mean, it's probably like, you can get like a cheap.
Maybe that's
tablet.
It. Maybe you get something with no Wi-Fi, no messaging capabilities. Just got a calculator. It's just a big fancy calculator with a touch screen.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that that's, you know, there's a lot of good free apps out there now that can just.
Oh yeah, yeah. Probably.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, so Moore's Law. This idea that thing. So as things are doubling and halving in size, right? There becomes this other idea here, right? Not only are we becoming more performant, but the sacrifice of compiling, the sacrifice of abstraction is becoming less, right? Because if we lose a little bit of performance because we're becoming more readable, because we're becoming more human-like, it doesn't matter as much, right? Because we're getting so much faster that negligible difference is starting to become more and more unimportant.
Yeah, exactly, right? We can afford to spend a little bit more time, a little bit more processing power to translate from things that are more powerful languages, right? Things that allow for humans to solve problems in different ways, that give you different layers of abstraction, that give you different ways of thinking or modeling problems, right? And at this point, once we get into, I guess, the 1960s, 1970s, there was really this explosion of programming languages in all kinds of different styles, right? People started to have different ideas, not just about how to solve particular problems, about how to write one program, but about how whole groups of people could write programs in the first place, right? Like people thought, okay, well, programs should be written using these building blocks, right? And other people had very different ideas about the building blocks that programs were built on top of. And so we saw a lot of different paradigms, you might say, start to emerge at this point.
Right. Different philosophies around how we should go about programming.
Exactly.
What is the best way to solve this problem? So our early programming languages, you know, after the release of these very, very early ones that came about, you know, alongside of assembly, started to provide us the ability to write logic, right? We could start doing things like if this, then this, right?
And you could write that using the English words, if, then, else, stuff like that.
Exactly. Right? We could even say things like repeat this operation X amount of times.
Right. Right. And what would that look like in code?
We could use something like a loop, right? Like a for loop or a while loop. We say while this thing holds true, continue this operation. Which is essentially just saying keep running this circuit.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, if you said that to a human being, you'd say while the sauce is still thin or runny or watery, keep stirring.
Man, we can't go one day without a food reference.
No.
We can't go one episode without a food reference.
I haven't had breakfast yet.
I ate breakfast.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to get a bagel after this, I think.
Oh, nice. Yeah. This Leo's real good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's where I'm going.
This is not a pitch for Leo's. It's, you know,
but if you're in the area, you'd be hard-pressed to beat Leo's for a good bagel.
That's right. Okay, so we saw this first this first level of abstraction was like, let us have logical control of our applications. And then we saw in the mid-1960s, 1970s, we saw this big breakout of like, okay, once we had these capabilities, how do we want to start organizing our larger scale? Our programs at this point aren't just like completing little rinky-dink algorithms that need to process some kind of like operate mathematical operation and be done, right? We needed
We're not just counting people in the country or something,
right? Right. We're trying to perform very complicated tasks.
Yeah, like building roller coasters.
Like building roller coasters, exactly.
Or managing huge databases of information.
Right. Right. Yeah, we should definitely do an episode on that too, talking about how we store data, how
databases,
we organize data, right?
For sure.
And go a little bit more into that. But now in the 1960s, 1970s, we have a demand for all of these things. And, you know, there a lot of different major paradigms came about to try to attempt to solve those problems, right? You know, and we can briefly talk about those, right? Like, one is this idea of functional programming, right?
Yeah.
Let's break
very
our
hot right
stories.
Now.
Very hot, right? And it's coming. It's
super hip.
Yeah. And it's sort of making a round trip. It's very back right now. And the idea behind it is pretty simple, right? Like, let's make our operations very small and very lean. And we can take our operations, like, let's say, take two numbers and add them, right? And if taking two numbers and add them produces another number, we can use another operation that might take in a number and produce something else.
Right.
And we can kind of pipe these things, pipe these functions, these blocks of operations into one another. And you could write one, and I could write one, and someone else can write another one. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the day, as long as they have these input-output controls and they're stable in what they take in and what they take out, we can then start to like pipe them together. Like put literally like yours, then take the output of that and put it into mine, and then take the output of mine and put it into someone else's.
Right. So at this point, programs are, we're building systems really, right? We're building these massive complex systems, and they're way too big in most cases for single individual coders to be building every part of it. But given well-designed languages or well-designed environments for writing programs, people can just focus on building a component, a tiny individual piece, a sort of module that gets fit into this larger system by gluing pieces together, right?
Right.
And so we've got this idea of two sort of parallel powers, I guess, in this paradigm here. We can break things down, modularize them so that we focus on solving one tiny little problem, but then we can also compose these pieces together. We can glue them together in very powerful ways, right, to build larger, complex systems that do just about anything you can imagine.
So what was the argument? This sounds pretty good. Like, what was the argument against this system? Like, what was like the competing paradigm? What was the other big competing paradigm?
Yeah. So the competing paradigm for a long time, I guess I would say, was more kind of imperative, I guess, programming. Object-oriented gets thrown out quite a bit. That's also kind of a more recent thing that is still around a lot today. You see lots of object-oriented languages, like Java, for instance, is a very heavily object-oriented language. But I think for a long time, functional programming wasn't really focused on quite as much outside of academia because computers were still not quite powerful enough to support the kinds of things that we wanted to build, right? They were a lot different than the way a computer actually worked at the hardware level. Whereas some other languages that emerged, like C, for instance, still hugely popular, has been used to build lots of things. Operating systems are often built in C, right? C much more closely mimicked how a computer worked at that bits and bytes level. And you could get very fine-grained control over moving individual things around in the computer's memory. Whereas functional programming was very abstract, right? It was like, you know, the simplest operation was still some sort of function, like add these two numbers together. It wasn't like grab the number out of this part of the computer's memory and perform this operation stored here. It was like very abstract, right? And I think only recently with the power of computers that we have today, have people started to look at that again and say, oh yeah, we actually don't have to worry so much about manually manipulating bits and bytes, about the performance there. We can write programs that just make it easier for us to solve problems.
Right.
Things that make it easier for us to think and understand these complex processes and let the machine take care of the dirty work behind the scenes.
Gotcha. And so these were some of the big, you know, these big programming paradigms came about pretty early on in the evolution of engineering, of software engineering, right? And so what was the big next step? Like what happened, you know, what big breakthrough came out that sort of took us from the C era, the C++ era, even into sort of the modern era?
Yeah. Are you talking about the internet?
I am. You said it.
Yeah. So the dawn of the internet, right? And this created not just a new way that people could write computer programs, right? It opened up a lot of different ways that people could collaborate to build these complex systems, but it created a whole new platform for software, right? The internet now is how people access huge, complicated computer programs, right? You go to Facebook.com or Google Maps or something, and you're loading up a massive computer program in your browser.
Right.
So along with that, we needed languages that were built to produce those sorts of things at scale. Right.
And this is sort of the early 90s, and we had a lot of competitors here, right? We had Scheme, right?
Yep.
We had Java, and of course,
the one and only.
The one and only. The one true Morty.
Your favorite and mine. One true Morty. JavaScript.
Oh, right. That's it. Yeah.
Right.
JavaScript. Cool.
Yeah.
And so we and this is, I feel like we've M. Night Shyamalan this whole thing, because it's like we could end on that, right? And we can say, like, you know, go back to our first episode and we talk about how JavaScript became so dominant and how it became so trendy and so cool and so sort of beat out a lot of these other languages for its presence in web browsers. But that's not to say that these other languages don't have really strong holds and strong places in the field, right? Like Java to this day, if you are writing an application for an Android device, you need to write in Java, right? There's no choice. Like, even if you write in one of these modern day JavaScript frameworks, like React Native, right? One of these, we'll get into all these complicated, you know, competitors in the JavaScript space later on. But, you know, at the end of the day, it still has to be Java. And how do we convert something from one language to another? Well, we compile, right? We compile.
So we've, at this point, got more programming languages than you could even think of, more than anybody could name off the top of their head, I think. Hundreds, thousands, I think, of computer programming languages have been developed. And many of them are in use across the world in lots of different environments. We've kind of reached the point where if you want to build something, one of the things that you have to decide is what's the right language to use for this. And maybe that's dependent on where you want to build it. If you're writing code that's supposed to run in a browser, you're writing it in JavaScript. If you're writing code for an Android phone, like you said, you're probably writing it in Java, right? But there are also lots of problems where you've got options and you can say, well, how does this problem best get solved?
Right.
What's the best way to model this problem mentally or through code? And so with these layers of abstraction, we've given ourselves a lot of power.
Right.
And we could end there, but I also love to think a little bit about where this might be going.
But there's more.
Right. So we don't have to get into it too much right now, but just kind of food for thought, I guess. I think living in the present, as we all do, we often tend to think of history as something that has led us to this very point. And it's like, now we've figured it out. We've got all these programming languages. We've got this great internet thing, right? We've got all these tools that allow us to be productive. This is what programming is.
Right.
But who knows what things are going to look like in a decade or two.
Right.
Maybe even in just a few years. Things are moving so quickly now, it's really tough to keep up with.
Right.
And I'm really excited to kind of see what ways people will come up with to solve the problems of the future, what abstractions people will come up with. Maybe we'll continue writing code in different languages that will start to emerge. Maybe there will be different media. Maybe we'll make computer programs in something that doesn't look like typing code in a computer at all.
Right.
Who knows?
Right. And I think that's sort of the takeaway from this lecture, right? This podcast episode. That's the takeaway from this episode. And that is, we need to understand where this came from and understand this idea of how we can organize information. At the end of the day, it needs to be machine code. But if we can find a system of getting it to be ones and zeros, then whatever that abstraction is, as long as we can go back to ones and zeros, is fine. That works.
Yeah.
We can do it. And there's so many different levels of abstraction at this point that allow us the opportunity to think differently, talk differently, right? The same way that, like, if you speak multiple languages, sometimes, like, you know, like human languages, not
right.
computer languages, right? People say, like, oh, I can't convey this thought in English. Like, this is something that I can't physically use words in English to produce. Like, there's a lot of things that maybe you even think that you don't know how to say. Right, it's like there are differences between these languages because of the routes of abstraction that they've taken,
yeah.
right? And so some languages are very good at graphing and math and are heavy on mathematical operations, like R, for example, right?
Right.
But if you're looking for a heavy graphical application that's going to be beautiful in design and more graphical kind of route, you might be looking for something like C++ or C#,
sure.
right?
Yeah.
It's very interesting, sort of the route that we've taken here.
Just like different natural human languages, like, you know, say English versus Mandarin or something versus Arabic, right? They all have different ways of conveying different ideas. Learning these languages can make you think differently. They can sort of change the way you look at things. They alter your perspective. I think you've got something similar in these different methods of problem solving. You can get the same result in many different ways, and having familiarity with a few of them can really kind of expand the way that you approach these problems in the first place, the tools that you have mentally to solve different kinds of challenges.
I do want to actually mention one more thing that this just made
sure.
me realize. So we talked about compiling. We talked about this process of, like, we write some code. We go through this step of compiling it down into a machine understanding binary, like, system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we execute it, right? There's this separation step, right, where we write code. We need to compile that code and then execute that machine statement. Is this always how we're doing it? Like, has that changed at all? Like, has that paradigm always been the same?
Oh, you mean like ahead of time we write some code and then we translate it and then what's the output of that, right? Like, is it a series of ones and zeros that we then run on a computer, or is this like we have some code that the computer is translating line by line live, like it sort of executes an instruction as soon as it sees it? Is that the distinction you're asking?
That's exactly what I'm getting at. It's like, was it always this write everything, compile everything, run everything?
That's kind of how it started, but it doesn't have to be that way anymore. And we have things, so you talked about compilers. There's also the idea of things called interpreters, which are doing compilation behind the scenes. They still have to translate these higher level languages like, you know, JavaScript and Ruby and stuff like that. They have to translate those down into machine code instructions, but an interpreter will do this on the fly as it's reading the code. It's like it sees something that's like, you know, while this do X, right? And it'll just start doing it right away. And then it keeps reading and it gets to the next instruction and it's like, add these two numbers. It's like, all right, got it. I'm going to do it. And then I'm going to keep reading.
Yeah.
So that's an interpreter versus a compiler.
Right. And this is pretty cool because now we could write code and sort of run it like as it's reading our code, not instead of going through this separate process of like, oh, now I need to compile this application. Let's just compile things as we need it, right? Like, why compile, you know, 63 million lines of code like Facebook, you know, ahead of time when we might not even be using most of it,
right?
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are reasons to do either one, compilation ahead of time or interpretation on the fly live as you're reading the code. But what we're seeing now starting to emerge is programs that combine the best of both worlds. Mm. Maybe they start by kind of doing things really quickly, interpreting things on the fly, but then as you use the program, when the computer has some resources freed up, it might start to optimize and compile a new version of the code that works a little bit better, right? So there's a lot of creative solutions going on in this space.
Hmm. That's actually really neat, like create like a rough draft almost, and then as you're going along, like kind of, if you have time, try to fix it and optimize it. And
exactly, yeah. And that's actually exactly how the V8 JavaScript engine in Chrome and Node, that's how that works. It comes up with basically a rough draft that works, it's correct, but maybe not the most efficient. And then when it's got some time freed up after it's finished that first draft, it goes back and does some optimizing compilation.
Cool.
Comes up with a better, more efficient version.
Cool. Yeah. All right, so we definitely talked about a lot of things today. Hopefully you feel like you have a better understanding of like how this process sort of works and how it can continually change, right? As long as at the end of the day we have instructions that are ones and zeros that the machine can understand, we have infinite possibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think I'm a little teched out for the morning.
All right. I'm done with you.
See you next time. If you're enjoying Teched Out, you might know other people who would enjoy it too. Help them find us by sharing the podcast on social media. And remember to subscribe on whichever podcast platform you're listening to this on right now, so you never miss a new episode. You can also follow us on Twitter at @teched_out. That's TECHD_OUT. And as always, thanks for listening.